Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the managing editor at Crosscut. There are many things going wrong in the world, and a lot of the time, those things seem just too big to do anything about. Especially when it comes to climate change, people often feel helpless. What it will take is systemic change, not individual change. But Sarah Lazarevic, an illustrator, visual journalist, and columnist for Yes Magazine, argues that small things do make a difference. And the research shows it. Yes Magazine is a nonprofit media organization focused on solutions journalism, and Lazarevic's column is called Small Works. There, she illustrates the tiny shifts in our lives that can help us feel human, find inspiration, and have hope. Crosscut invited Lazarevic to offer her insights into some of the simple ways we can all take action. Christine Hanna is executive director at Yes Media. She introduced the talk. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and the Nature Conservancy. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
Hi, everyone. Ooh, all right, you can hear me fine, right? Welcome to this session called Small Works. My name is Christine Hanna. I'm the executive director at Yes Media. And first, I want to thank Crosscut for hosting the Crosscut Festival. It's a big vision, which is impressive to begin with, and then they actually followed through with it, which is even more impressive. So big thanks to them for bringing people together in place to talk about big ideas. I also want to thank the title sponsor for Crosscut Festival, which is Comcast, and also the Nature Conservancy, who has sponsored the science and environment track for the day. So let's see, how many people here are familiar with Yes Magazine? Lots of folks, okay, and several of you who aren't, all right. So Yes Magazine is, or Yes Media, we're a nonprofit media organization, and we have a mission. Our mission is to create a more just, sustainable and compassionate world, and we do that through journalism, specifically solutions journalism. And what we do is we cover how communities are responding, that is real people in real places, how they are solving big problems in their communities. And we have been doing this work for 23 years. We were founded in 1996, headquartered on Bainbridge Island for almost all of that time. And we just moved our headquarters to Seattle a few months ago as part of an overall strategy to really increase the number of people who are being inspired by these ideas of what's happening in communities all around the country and how they can be a part of this growing community of people who are working to build a better world. So, I would like to introduce Sarah. Oh, I forgot to ask you. Really? Oh, good. Okay. Because I have two A's. Lazarevic. Is that right? All right. Sarah Lazarevic, who is a visual journalist who has been working with Yes for the past, almost 2 years, I think, year and a half or so. And there's a little story behind that. Is Tracy here? No, Tracy is our editorial director, and she had read a book that Sarah had written called, it's on my phone, hang on. She can tell me, but no, I'm going to do it myself. Here we go. A Bunch of Pretty Things I Did Not Buy, which is a great title to begin with. And Sarah read this book, and she thought, God, Sarah has this like sort of systems level view of consumerism and capitalism, and she's funny, which is a rare combination when you're talking about consumerism and capitalism to also be able to be funny. And so she got in touch and they hatched this plan where we asked our readers, we publish a quarterly print magazine and we also publish online daily. We have a large online audience, and we asked our online audience to tell us something that they really wanted to buy, but they really knew they shouldn't. And Sarah picked her favorites, and then she painted them. And she put them together in this comic essay that went with a story about how to not buy things you don't really need. And it was such a hit for us at the time. It was really a viral hit. And so we decided to continue to working together. And she's now done a column for us called Small Works for the past several issues. And so we are so excited to have Sarah. She's also happens to be, she's been on like every media outlet in Canada. I think that's why she's funny, because she's Canadian, maybe. Not sure. Anyway, so one thing I want to say is that if you are not familiar with Yes Magazine, but you would like to become more familiar with it, you can buy a subscription today. We have a table in the Piggott Building. You can also sign up for an email newsletter, and we are giving away an iPad because everybody needs another iPad. If you subscribe or you sign up for an email subscription. So thank you all so much for being here. And yes, team, did I miss anything? No? Okay. Well, then, without further ado, please welcome Sarah Larozovic.
Thank you so much. I think I've got laughs. I'm good. Can everybody hear me? Oh, awesome. I'm going to sit. That was such a nice introduction. Thank you so much. I actually forgotten that's how Tracy reached out to me, which never happens when you're a journalist. Usually you pitch editors 1,000 times and never hear back. So when an editor actually reaches out to you to hire you, it's like the best thing in the world. So I can't believe I forgot that. First of all, I want to thank everybody for coming. I always get super nervous when I talk for more than 10 minutes, even though I love talking. But my dad said, don't worry, you're up against Valerie Jarrett, so no one's going to come to you. But you're all here. And then he said also, you're at the time slot before happy hour, so no one's really listening anyway because they just want to go drink. So I feel a lot better now and I'm ready. I want to say thank you for all the, there's so many amazing programs and you chose to come to my talk about small things and how you can take big actions. So I'm going to draw. So this is new for me to try to draw in public very quickly. So I think there's so many prejudices in the world that we unearth and talk about, but being smallest is one of the last ones. And in particular, I think in one of my last Yes cartoons, I was talking about people making fun of people for wanting to not take straws. And then people say, oh, why are you doing that? It doesn't matter at all. Like, who cares if there's one more straw in the world? And it's so smallest. Like, how dare you tell somebody what is okay to do and what's not okay to do? Because every little thing can beget greater change, and if everybody stops using straws, then we've done something. So that's a little bit of the setup for this talk. And I guess what I want to say is, in working up to this idea of small works as both a column and as something that I tend to talk about and use a lot in my work, I really rail against this idea of people saying that individual responsibility doesn't matter. And obviously, we need systems change. We need things to happen at a huge macro level. But that never should preclude us from taking individual reactions. The academic spin on this, there's a new term that I now see people using, the individuation of responsibility. And you know, it's like people very academically getting down on someone for thinking that the work must be done by the individual and that it's this negative corporate force making all this responsibility shift from the larger systems change effort to the smaller individual. And I would say maybe that's true in some cases, but mostly it's that people actually just want to do things and they need to do things to feel empowered and to feel like they can help and that they can keep things going on in the world. And so I really just hate the idea of belittling the little. And the other main thing that if anybody works in change making or ever tries to do anything at a grassroots level knows is that there's this common refrain, it's a behavioral economics thing, this idea of the normalcy, the narrative fallacy, wherein if you say you're doing something small and people can find a way to poke holes in it, like or if you say you're doing anything at all and it's not perfect, then people will chip away at it. So for example, anytime somebody talks about climate change and someone points out the fact that they flew to the conference in a plane, it's like, we know the system still needs to change, but how was Bernie Sanders supposed to get from New York City to California for an event the next day? So this idea that one thing precludes another is, I think, quite erroneous. And this talk is about how to make sure you can get your small ideas out there. I was going to make a joke about this being a straw argument, but I'm going to start. So anyway, I'm going to try to delete my bad jokes as I go. So there's one realm in which I think incrementalism does equal denial, and in just about every other arena, I don't think so. So before I start a talk, and before someone gives me this normative, this narrative fallacy and says, well, what about climate change? I think climate change is the one arena in which incremental change can be used as a cudgel, because you see politicians talking about, oh, we can't move too quickly, you know, the world's gonna fall apart if we get off oil too quickly and all these things. And we know that that's just, we have to move more quickly than we are. So I agree that, you know, when you use incrementalism as an excuse for the larger changes that you're afraid to make, or you have some corporate lobbying person telling you that can't be done, we know that that's not the case. We know we need to make those changes. But what is full-scale change but a lot of incremental changes all put together? So even then, when people make that argument, I'm like, well, yes, but how do you think full-scale change happens? So the one other thing I want to say is that small change doesn't preclude big change, it foments it. So we do all these little things in order to push people towards bigger change. Often you'll be on social media and someone will explain some little thing they're doing and they're like, you know, I got rid of my car. And someone's like, oh, that's not so great. You got rid of your car. What we really need to do is like take down Shell. It's like, well, don't you think the person who cares about getting rid of their car is the person who's gonna work towards taking down Shell? So once again, all these caveats about small change being this thing that we need to, yes, think long and hard about when we're advocating for it, but also being aware of the many biases that people bring to it and how often they use these ridiculous arguments to take apart the work of everyday people trying to get things done towards a larger goal. So a little about me. How did I end up being this weird person who's interested in small things? I sort of reverse engineered it, and this is what I think happened. I do the worst drawing of my home state. This is how I always draw it. I grew up in Florida, and because I don't like Florida, I don't ever bother to draw it properly. Sometimes I do. There's Lake Okeechobee. You know, I grew up kind of over here in a really superficial, kind of horrible place. I think it's gotten a lot better, but I feel like I didn't really have a political conscience whatsoever when I was growing up. I sort of believed in the idea of taking care of the world. I was in like a Girl Scout troop kind of thing where we recycled and picked up litter. I loved thrift. I was always a thrift store person, and I like instinctively didn't like the consumerism that was all around me because it tended to be a very shopping, consumerist-minded place in which I grew up. But I really was kind of afraid of nature. I thought like if I went too far from a strip mall, I'd get eaten by an alligator. And I spent a lot of my time indoors reading and didn't really appreciate nature a lot. Side note to that, I later realized there's so much nature in Florida, and I wrote a column about Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, the most amazing environmentalist, but unfortunately, I didn't know about her when I was growing up there. So I didn't know anything about the environment, and I didn't have anybody to really look to teach me about the environment when I was growing up. And then I moved to Canada and went to university in Montreal, and I met all these people who had political thoughts and ideas and like cared about things. And I was like, oh, this is really interesting. They go to protests, they are interested in the world, they're not just like listening to music and painting pictures by themselves. And I started really thinking about things more. But even then, I didn't really think about the way that it all fit together. It was in my early 20s when I finally started working and earning money, and realizing that my coming of age when it came to purchasing power really paralleled the rampant rise in consumerism. Like, yes, consumerism existed in the 80s, but if you look at fast fashion, it was really something that appeared most heavily in the early aughts, when suddenly we had the rise of H&M and Zara, and just sort of consumerism on warp speed. Like, yes, I spent a lot of time buying scrunchies at the Gap when I was 10, but like things did not really ramp up to the extent that they are, to the way we have them today, where, you know, H&M and Zara get new clothes every 12 minutes, and people just buy so much more than they did between, I think, really my coming age, between the 1980s and now. And it started, like, really hitting me like a ton of bricks, and I was noticing it everywhere, and I was noticing that, like, as a person who used to only shop at thrift stores, why was I buying weird things at H&M that I didn't need? And started reading a lot about fast fashion, and I did a year of no shopping, and then it became this thing where a lot of people did years of no shopping and not buying anything, and then I did another one, and I wrote about it, and I got invited to write a book about it, and it just became this thing that really, like, it sort of gelled together all these ideas I had about where society was going and made it real for me. And I think for a lot of people, and I wouldn't just ghettoize women, but because women tend to be considered the larger shoppers, it's a way into environmental issues that a lot of women find themselves realizing because they're more around this stuff, and fast fashion is such a, like, fashion in general and buying is generally segregated to the world of women buy too many things. No one ever says that men buy too many things. But I digress. Anyway, so this turned into me making all these weird viral charts, one of which I have some extra cards, which I'll pass around, called the Biohierarchy of Needs. And really what I realized the through line was is these are all, I've got so many extras. They're just for people to have. I realized what I was doing is just creating these little shorthand ways of people understanding and thinking about shopping and thinking about sustainability, and it was my way of getting into these topics. So for me, that's why small, because it was something that if for someone who I neglected to talk about the main point. I think some people can jump into activism or trying to change the world at a macro scale right away, but a lot of people can't. A lot of people are not going to go from not caring about things to suddenly protesting or going on strike, and I am one such person. Like, for me, everything is a bit of a slow move. Like, I'm not a Band-Aid ripper-offer, I'm a Band-Aid incher. I never jump into a lake right away, I inch very slowly. And I think, you know, part of being a person who wants to make change is understanding what kind of person you are. And I slowly realized that, no, I had to, like, it took me 2 years to get up the strength to go to a protest because I thought they might be scary. And I was like, well, are people going to throw things at me? Am I going to get tear gassed at a climate protest? And then I finally went and I was like, oh, no, this is great. And then I could move on to the next thing. So I think a lot of the times we talk about this idea of go big or go home, and the fact that you can only do things if you're going to go huge and take on the world, and I think it's elitist, and I think it doesn't accommodate the fact that there are a million different ways to do things, and why would you want to close things off to people who can otherwise not partake of them. A lot of the things that we ask people to do as well are, like, not everyone can take a day off work to go to a protest. Not everybody can drop everything that they're doing. They work. I work, and I'm always like, oh, I want to go to this May Day protest. I want to go to this thing. And it's, how many days a week off do I have to go to go do these things? So I think part of why I'm such a fan of small is just it meets people where they are, and it realizes that there are so many different ways to want to make change in the world. I'm also a student of behavioral science. And so one of the key things that I'm interested in is this idea. I'm forgetting to draw because I'm just talking so much. Is the erroneous idea that we actually make change and can take on big things instantaneously. And suddenly, like, if you told someone you're going to run a marathon and you weren't going to train at all and you were going to run the marathon the next day, they would laugh you out of, the place. It doesn't happen, right? So this idea that we can always just, like, jump into things and do them perfectly right away at a macro scale is a bit faulty. The term for breaking out your goal into discrete pieces is called chunking. In behavioral science, you want to think about the long-term goal, the huge thing, the huge kind of change you want to affect, but you want to think, okay, so what's my first step on my path to get there? And then you want to achieve that goal before you move on to the next one, because that will both give you the confidence to get to the next step and also make it manageable, because if you set goals that are a million times further than where you're able to reasonably go, you're just gonna feel failure. And this is true of anything, not just the goal of making change. I mean, this is an exercise, this is in any domain, like, I don't know, trying to get in shape, what have you. You wanna make your goal manageable and you wanna add them all together so that you get where you wanna go eventually. So another behavioral science thing that comes into play when we talk about small, it was coined by Robert Cialdini, who's kind of the one of the founders of the idea of persuasive psychology and behavioral science, and it's the commitment consistency principle. You want to do something small, you want to get someone to do something small so that they can always see themselves as that kind of person. So the main example they use in this regard, and it's from a sales point of view or from a political point of view, if you go up to someone's house, the famous study is, and you ask them to put a tiny little sticker in their window advocating something, and they say yes. Well, then when you go back and ask them to put a 4-foot-wide sign on their lawn supporting the same thing, the people who have taken the small sticker are inordinately more likely to do so. Why? Because they've created a self-image in which this is consistent with their beliefs. They are now the kind of person who says yes to putting the sticker supporting X product or candidate in their window. So you've set them up to do something that's aligned with their self-identity. And the same is true of small actions. So when someone says, oh, I'm refusing straws now, even though, yes, you may laugh and say, this is a tiny little thing, this idea of refusing a straw, they now view themselves, oops, as the kind of person who refuses straws. And so, you know, what's next? They're refusing all cutlery and they're eating with their bare hands. I don't know. But like they're on the path, right? And so it's more than just, oh, I refuse straws now. It's like, oh, I'm the kind of person who refuses straws. And this is consistent with my self-identity. So the next time you ask that person to do something wasteful, like take a paper cup or what have you, they may very well say no because it no longer aligns with their self-identity. They're now the kind of person who does this thing. I'm really forgetting my drawing. I refuse straws. I don't know why I'm drawing that. I'm past that now. The other idea is small change as gateway. So just they're saying, you know, it's in tandem with the consistency principle. You know, you do one thing and it opens up a whole new realm because just as in my case, like, oh, I can go to protests now. I'm the kind of person who can go to protests. Oh, I can write letters now. Oh, I can write letters to my MP. Oh, I'm not afraid to call somebody. It opens up a new realm and you can't actually know what the realm of your ability to make change is going to be until you get to that new step, right? It's like you're climbing a hill and you don't know that you may have this capacity to do these amazing things until you get to that next step. So when I think about this idea of small change as gateway, a good example, my daughter has this amazing teacher. They're doing this unit on zero waste right now, and she has like drunk the Kool-Aid hard, which is adorable, except when you have like all your own annoying things that you say reflected back to you by your 8-year-old, and she's like, Mom, you took a plastic bag, and I'm like, oh, I didn't mean to. Anyway, but the point is, she's in French immersion, so it sounds much better. She made a poster called Comment de vivre sans poubelle, and I would name her poubelle if it didn't mean trash, but Comment de vivre sans poubelle, and she loves this, and she's really like thinking about zero waste all the time now. Had she not made this little poster, I don't know that I would have been able to get her to do this thing that we're doing now, which is a friend of mine started a project called Make a Change in May, which is about committing to something on the gamut of working towards zero waste for the month of May and taking on much bigger things. But because she took ownership of this small thing, of making this poster about little things she wanted to do at school, now she's like, she's all in, right? So this idea that like small, the domain of small always stays small is so faulty because as soon as you do something small, you're like, bring it on, you know? And I asked her to write our goals for our family, for our household, what we wanted to take on for the month of May, and she went right at it. And she's like, no packaging, search out candy with no packaging. Like, she's got the whole thing down. And also, that's great, because I want her to have the accountability and ownership of the idea itself. So once again, small change as gateway. Another thing I want to talk about is the idea of small change at the community level. So my latest piece that's about to come out in Yes Magazine is about an amazing woman named Yvonne Odom, who I didn't know about at all until a couple months ago, randomly from reading a New York Times article in which she happened to be quoted. And it said that there was a woman who had desegregated a high school in Delray Beach, where I went to high school. But there's only one high school in Delray Beach. And I realized that moment, like, I'd never thought about the fact that my high school was once segregated and had to be desegregated by someone, by one person. And I don't know, it was kind of like an epiphany for me, like how many other things am I completely unaware of, but that's another story. But just like everything that we think of as these huge, like the civil rights movement we see as this huge thing, literally a movement that galvanized our country, and we know Ruby Bridges, and we know Vivian Malone, and we know, you know, later Rosa Parks, and we know all these different discrete stories because they became the representative stories. But we don't think about like, even the things that happen at scale still had to be happening on the ground by one person doing that small thing, which was no small thing. So she was, her dad was a minister. He was active in the civil rights movement in Palm Beach County, and they were looking for volunteers, and they wanted the volunteers who were gonna desegregate the schools to be super outgoing, the kind of people who would succeed. And she was in grade 9 at Carver, which was the black school in the town, black high school in the town, and she was on the homecoming court and on the basketball team, and like she just came home one day and her dad said, "You're gonna leave Carver and you're gonna desegregate Atlantic High School." And that's what she did. And so, you know, when you think about this, this is like, imagine how many thousands of schools that had to happen at, and how many of these, like these little actors did these things that had these huge repercussions. So, yeah, community, everything that happens writ large also always happens at the ground level in order to affect that huge change. We also talk in stories. So just for me telling you that story, it makes it much more vivid than if I told you that without a character. By day, I work as a creative director at a marketing agency. And one of the most common marketing truisms is that when you're doing appeals for our nonprofit clients in general, you never want to use an amorphous group or a faceless group. You'll have much more success. And this has been tested time and time again. I mean, this is why all appeals are like, support this one child and not support this vast cause where 10,000 people have perished, or, you know, people just do not respond to that. And it's not because people don't care, right? It's just they need to see that one example. And even when you do something, they've done studies where even if you do it with two people instead of one people, well, then your efficacy is diffuse. And instead of being able to help one person, you're like, oh, it seems like it's being spread around. And I want to know that I can just do one thing and affect that one change. So we talk in stories. I mean, people talk about the Pacific Garbage Patch all the time. And it's a perfect example because it's this amorphous blob that people say they care about, but they can't really see it or feel it, or like it's huge and they can't do anything. But then we constantly have these stories about a fish or a whale that washes up. And it's one animal, and they cut it open, and they say, look at all the trash inside this one animal. And suddenly you see like a huge, huge, huge range of action because people are galvanized by the one thing they can relate to, which is the one whale, as opposed to the pile of garbage that takes up 100,000 square miles. So it's all about small, is what I'm always getting at. Since I'm always telling stories, I'm going to tell one more story. Small is also the way to make yourself feel like you are empowered and you can do something, which is what I'm getting at through everything I say here. But a great example of this is last week, this adorable 12-year-old guy on my street, he's like the entrepreneurial 12-year-old of the street. He sells cotton candy and popcorn, and he's just an amazing character. He's always doing something. And I came home from work, and he had a giant bag, and he had one of those professional, I don't know, garbage picking, what do you call that? He had that, and he was getting all the garbage off our street, and he was so proud of himself that he was like, I'm picking up all the garbage on our street. Look how much I got. I got so much garbage. And he was kind of bragging about it, but it was amazing because he felt so empowered, right? Like, he felt so great, and that's what you want your actions to do. And, you know, it was half an hour at the end of his school day, but it gave him that strength, and he spread it around. And then I was like, okay, you're bragging a lot, but you're also amazing. Like, this is fantastic, and this is what we want to see. So yeah, this idea that small change, and partly why I also say that, you know, you never want to negate anyone's anything because it is so necessary for that person. The psychological and mental health benefits just cannot be underestimated. And if you think about it, like think about it in your own life, if you're having a horrible, horrible day and you're reading news writ large, like macro things about, you know, environmental regulations being ripped apart before your very eyes or God knows what, and you feel completely disempowered and hopeless, but then you go and you do one thing and it seems very superficial, like you, I don't know what it is, but like, you know, you pick up a piece of trash or you remember to bring your takeout mug, your reusable mug instead of your other thing, it can feel really empowering. And it's a tiny thing that makes you realize that, like, yes, all these things are happening, but I've done something and I'm okay and I'm gonna keep going. So psychological. Okay, so systems change. So it's a pretty famous curve, made all the more famous by Malcolm Gladwell, but you have your innovators, your early adopters, your early majority. I'm not gonna do the rest because they don't really matter. The point being that when we're talking about a system, something always propels that system into action. And there's this erroneous idea that like a system can just change on its own. So I was at a behavioral science conference last year, And this amazing hysterical guy gets up and talks, and I don't know how he's so funny because he works for the CRA, which is like our IRS, but maybe that's why he's so funny, because you have to be funny if you're just like dealing with tax people all day. And he tells us that his goal was to get the, we had a child benefit that was available to low-income people in Canada that nobody was taking because for a million reasons the bureaucracy was too complicated, but it was free money being left on the table. So he spent an entire year working on a pilot project where he did numerous little tests to see, you know, what would get people, which behavioral tools could he use to nudge people into taking this money that they really needed. It was an education benefit, and then it was just like free money for children in low-income families. And he had some amazing effects. He presented them, and everybody was dazzled and said, wow, that's great. And then he told us at the end of the talk, well, at the end of the year of his pilot study, the government actually just auto-enrolled everybody. And so they all got the benefit after that by, everybody got the benefit, which is amazing. And so you might think, well, you know, he was working at this small scale, trying really hard to make this thing happen, and then boom, it just happened by fiat. But it was because he was doing that, right? It was because the government saw him doing this thing and working so hard to show that you could get an uptake by 25% that they were like, oh, maybe we could just auto-enroll people and suddenly they would get the money that they really need. So this idea that, you know, one thing, that they're doing something small will just be overstepped when the larger systems change happens. No, that's what, like, the metaphor is like a bear stepping on a splinter. Eventually it realizes that, oh, there's this thing here that's nudging me to do something. Maybe I should change behavior or switch courses. So I thought that was a great story. Where was I? Oh, and the other idea is that it's unfortunate to say, but we actually don't know which of our changes, which of our little moves are going to have the repercussions we need, because as humans, we're deeply illogical people, and we all have different levers that work for us. You know, some people are motivated by shame, not our president, unfortunately. Some people are motivated by competition, and we work really hard to figure out what levers are going to work. But, you know, a million people may stand out on the mall protesting something, but then it's like a conversation that a senator has with one constituent that is actually the thing that shifts behavior. So we got to do everything. And small is about doing everything. It's like, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Do whatever you can do, and your neighbor will do whatever he can do, and together we'll get her done. My husband sent me this study that I look to all the time and that I've probably cited 100 times in the past 2 weeks, but it's basically research based on the adoption curve that it takes fewer people than you think to make change. It can take very few people. There was a great clip that I saw at another behavioral science conference of studies they do where they just have people, basically it's like hidden camera. It's like Just for Laughs. Oh, do you have Just for Laughs here? No. Oh, yeah? Okay. It's like a gag show almost, but it's basically getting one person to do something in the hopes that everybody else will follow. And it's remarkable how many times they would get someone to do something completely weird, and then everyone else would just do it. And we're not trying to get people to do things that are completely weird. We're trying to affect change. So it takes fewer people than you think to foment that change or galvanize momentum. It's about getting people to that place where they see that there's more than one person doing something, and the thing that was once abnormal becomes socially normative. Because the more we can make something that we want to happen a social norm or a habit, the more likely we are to make sure that that change sticks. So what little you can do is what I like to call it. How do we make things actually happen? The number one rule of behavioral science is make it easy. You want to make something a habit so that it's not hard, you're not constantly pushing someone to do something. It's something that is part of their identity, either through commitment and consistency, or through social pressure, or because it's now normative. You want it to be something that they just do because it's what's done. So I'll use the example that I use all the time for everything. When you talk about bringing your own mug to the coffee shop, some people think that that's not a big deal. So what? It's paper cup. When you bring your mug to the coffee shop, it's not just the bringing your mug, saving one cup of coffee. Sorry, I keep doing that, audio guy. It's the fact that, for example, in my office, I get up and I take my mug, And my colleagues see me take my mug, and they're like, oh yeah, I kept forgetting. I keep leaving my mug at home. I forgot. I walk down the block, and people see me carrying my mug. And I'm like, hey, look at my mug. I'm so great. But, you know, they just see my mug. And they're like, oh yeah, takeaway mug. I left mine at my cubicle. And then I get to the coffee shop, and the barista's like, oh, personal mug. And everyone here is personal mug. And it, like, resounds in their brain. Oh, right, I could have gotten the 30-cent discount if I hadn't left my mug back at my desk. And before you know it, you realize the repercussions of just one little tiny thing are actually quite enormous, right? And then think about the time where, like, two people happen to bring their personal mug at once, and the person in the middle of them is like, oh, everybody's bringing their personal mug now. I better bring mine. This is a thing, and I'm horrible, right? Not that we want that person to feel horrible, but I'm just saying it doesn't take much to start a habit that then begets all these other changes. My friend Anne, I do a climate change newsletter about being hopeful and making little changes, and my friend Anne has always been this kind of shy person who doesn't want to take up too much space or ask for too much attention. But like me, she was kind of like waking up in the middle of the night, worried about climate change, feeling like she wasn't doing enough. So a couple of weeks ago, she got this idea that she was going to start the project I was talking about earlier called Make a Change in May. And she was just going to send a note to a bunch of friends and Facebook friends. And if you wanted to join her, you could. And it could be anything. It could be as little as just, I'm not going to take as many take out mugs at the coffee shop, to I'm going to try to be zero waste for the whole month of May. And her husband, who's like a great person, but he sounds horrible when I tell you this, he was like, you're going to be lucky if you get four people. I can't see anyone doing that. And she did it. And I think the group now is like at 180. Everyone wanted to join in, right? Because everybody likes to do something that seems like a discrete amount of time, a challenge. You can meet us at your level. You can do that. Like, I'm just going to try to take fewer paper cups, or you can go big. It has accountability because you join the Facebook group and you say, I'm here, help me, I'm going to do this thing. Like, it was just the perfect storm of, like, a great idea. And if you think about it, it sounds small, but now 180 people, who are not just people, because most of them are families, most of them are moms with families, that's like hundreds of people now reducing their waste on a scale, you know, on par with. Once again, we're talking about small versus nothing when you're against small. So all these people doing nothing versus all these people, and yes, it's not the whole government suddenly banning single-use plastics. We still have a long way to go, but the government bans single-use plastics when it sees that every single person really, 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 really cares about this issue and is gonna vote them out of office if they don't do something. So I thought that was a great example. My biography of needs that I handed out a bunch of, I never know what people are going to find interesting or funny. Like, sometimes the thing that I think is hilarious and I post online, like, dies with, like, a cosmic thud, and everyone's like, that was not good at all. And then this hierarchy of needs just seems to have taken a life of its own and, like, flown around the world, and it's been translated I've translated it. People send me their translations, and I redraw it in, like, I think I'm at 15 languages now. And the thing is, it's a tiny little thing. All of this is a little heuristic for thinking, for reminding yourself that when you're about to go buy something, maybe you actually can already use what you have, and then you can move up or borrow it from someone. It's so simple, right? But then every time someone posts about it on Instagram, they like send me a great note, and they're like, oh, I was gonna buy this thing, but I didn't. And I'm like, this is great. I wish I had a tally of like all the things people didn't buy because of one tiny little chart. One time when someone covered my book for the Daily Mail, and it was kind of what you were talking about, Christine, they added up or the total of all the things I didn't buy but had painted instead. And they're like, woman saves 20. It was the Daily Mail. So they're like, woman saves 20,000 pounds by painting things instead of buying them. And I'm like, no, I wasn't actually really going to buy all those things. But the point being, we don't see the change. We don't see what people didn't buy, which is the important stuff, right? I thought that was another great example. So the one thing I will say is you always want to be strategically small. The reason people chafe when they see other people do small things is because sometimes people do really nonsensical small things, and I think they're still totally valid, right? Whatever you need to do on that path to change is valid, but if someone sees something that seems like it took an undue amount of effort when they could have been doing something equally, that took the same amount of time and achieved somewhat the same, they get frustrated. But if you're strategically small and you can articulate to people why it is that you're doing this small thing on this path towards a larger change, you tend to get them on side. And the thing is, once you can articulate to them, they likely will come on side. The best example of that is, like, who knew about Greta Thunberg, like, am I pronouncing her name right? A couple months ago. I mean, it was such a simple, small thing. Every Friday, sitting outside, and she did it for, like, I think over a year until people finally caught on. But, like, now the whole world is catching on. And literally 3 days ago, the UK government declared a climate emergency, largely because of her and her work. So something, again, strategically small. What could she actually do? She's a 16-year-old. She didn't have money. She didn't have outsized power. She has a piece of cardboard that says climate strike, students for climate strike, and she sits outside. And now it's this huge, huge, huge thing. So yeah, strategically small. What is the thing? Is the thing that you're creating scalable, and can it have these wider repercussions? So I guess that leads me to my next conclusion. I'm running out of time, even though I usually go short. You want to set your small up for success. So you want to pick a fight and focus. There's a comically long list of our horrible premier in Ontario. Like, he's only been in power less than a year, and he's done like a million terrible things. And when I look at the list, I kind of want to have a heart attack and start crying, or do both at the same time, and then I want to go eat ice cream. But anyway, this list is so horrible that I'm like, I'm just actually going to pick one thing, and that's going to be my thing. And he recently eliminated a $4 million annual fund that went towards planting trees, and which is like such a negligible amount of money for our carbon sequestration budget. Like, it did so much. And you know, at the same time, he's giving money to like horse racing. So it's like, out of the 130 things on this list, that's gonna be the one thing I'm gonna work on, because I can't work on everything. I'm gonna pick a fight and focus. And so once again, that's this idea of small. Is there something that you can pluck off and concentrate all your efforts towards? And you know, people don't respond to diffuse requests, to vagary. If you can give them something small and concrete and actionable and explain why, then they're likely to come along for the ride. As humans, we like to think that we're going to change dramatically overnight, even though it's kind of the furthest thing from the truth. Like, my neighbor across the street does this amazing program called the 28-Day Transformation Challenge, and it's this online program that people sign up to do, and I've done it once. It's really fun, but it's about like eating more healthfully and learning how to exercise and everything, and like, you know, everybody expects that in 28 days they're going to be completely transformed into this, you know, outsized, amazing, perfect incarnation of themselves. And in reality, like, everybody enjoys it and feels good at the end, but it's not like your life changes overnight and you suddenly like look like this completely different and feel like this completely different version of yourself. Barring huge life events, we rarely change dramatically. I mean, everyone's probably heard about this very often cited thing that whether you have a death in the family or win the lottery, you know, your peak highs and lows tend to come back to what you generally feel most of the time. So a year after you win the lottery, you're generally about the same level of happy. A year after someone dies, you're generally about the same level as happy. You sort of return to your norm. And this idea that, you know, you can drastically change things and completely transform yourself is kind of erroneous. At the same time, people have this opposite thing that is also slightly faulty, in so much as we think that the system can't change very rapidly, which is actually not true. A big beastly system can actually change quite quickly, and I always cite him, but Bill McKibben makes that point very articulately in 350.org. Lots of other people make this point a lot too. I call it the nugget of hope, this idea that when we have to, when we're actually really pressed to change, a system can change really quickly. In the case of climate change now, people can't see it, so they don't realize, even though we constantly are raising the terror threat and saying this is happening, people don't see it. But in the case of World War II, he talks about how we pivoted on a dime when we had to. And people did, you know. People planted victory gardens on their front lawns, factories that produce cars suddenly produced tanks, and we did it. And those changes were actually, you know, they sound mammoth, and it was hard. It was a hardship. You know, people were at war. Everyone was eating different things, and there was definitely privation in a lot of ways. But those were all small changes that happened in the aggregate across a huge population. So we changed our mindset and our framing in order to get these things done. Last week, when Greta Thunberg said, we can't solve an emergency without treating it as an emergency, I thought that was great, because what she was literally doing is trying to tell us that we need to change the framing. And when we change that framing, then all of us and all our different actions can come into play, and we can actually try to affect the change that needs to happen at scale. So, what are my takeaways? I think the obvious one that I've tried to hit home a ton is, whatever anyone does, don't diminish it, support it. No matter what, like when my kid is like, I saved a piece of paper, like, that's amazing. Like, that's great, because you're thinking about it. I mean, that's great. And you want to make sure that whatever someone is doing, you support it, because doing something is always better than doing nothing. Like, in an earlier talk today, Kristen Ebby, who was on the Apocalypse Now climate panel and contributed to the IPCC report on climate change, was like, everything matters. We have all the solutions we need, but everything matters. So, you know, the huge geoengineering solution matters, but also the concerned citizens trying to stop using plastic bags matter. So we have to do it all. Because the small things give you strength to keep going. And you don't want anyone to ever, ever, ever stop you from doing them. And while small does not have to be a pathway to big, some people can stay small their whole lives, and that's great. If you do a small thing all the time and you don't want to scale it up and you don't have time or need or feel impassioned to, it's still doing something. But small can also be that pathway to huge, huge, huge change. And when people talk about going viral, I'm like, going viral is just a change in perceived scale. It's just this: when someone does something small and suddenly goes viral, it's because the perceived scale of that change suddenly flew all around the world. And I love that, because it's like you have no idea how this thing is gonna, how something you do is gonna transcend what the level you've created it at. And my friend Anne, who was like, I'm only gonna get 10 people, and then I joined in, and then everyone else joined in. And I mean, now she's at 180. She never imagined that, and it's amazing. So yeah. So I think when I was talking about the name of this talk with Jake, the director of this festival, we were talking about force multipliers. And force multiplier is kind of harsh, because it's like a physically, it's almost like it comes from the world of, you know, violence almost. But actually, a force multiplier is just a bunch of, it can also just be a bunch of people putting all their hands together to give something strength, and putting their ideas together and putting their time and effort together to turn something small into something large. And I really love that. One thing that I was hoping that we could do, am I okay for time? Yeah. Is I have post-it notes, and I was gonna pass them around because this is supposed to be a workshop. I realize it's a workshop in which I talked for 40 minutes. but the one thing that I find really helpful is, it's also from behavioral science, but number one is the idea of implementation intention, which is, and I want everyone to take two post-its because I selfishly want to keep everybody's, but implementation intention is writing down your goal. If you write down your goal, you're much more likely to achieve it. So however small it might be, you write down that thing you want to do and you're likely to make good on it. So when my daughter wrote down that her plan was to find candy with no packaging, I know she's really serious. And the other thing is that writing down your goal and giving it to someone else gives you accountability. So what I'm hoping you'll do is write your goal down twice. Write it down once and keep it for yourself, and then write it down another time and give it to me. And if you want to, put your contact info on there, if you want me to, and I will email you in 2 weeks to say, did you do the thing that you said you were going to do? And this can be a big thing if you want it to be, but I suggest that it's just something small that you've been meaning to do, because we all have a million small things we've been meaning to do. I had been meaning to make my house more zero waste, but didn't get around to it until my friend started this challenge. I'd been meaning to remember to keep Tupperwares at work for any takeout ever before I started this challenge, but I didn't. So just writing those things down helped me make good on them. So go for it. I know in other panels people have asked questions, but I haven't been to any panels like this one, so if you have questions, I'm happy to answer them. Yes. Sure. Sorry. No, I was supposed to ask you to have a microphone.
We want to catch the audio.
Cool. As you were talking, I was reminded of some readings I've come across from BJ Fogg, who's a...
I love BJ Fogg. Tiny Habits.
Yes. So I think you touched upon a lot of the things. He has three main points in making change, and one is that you need the motivation, but then you also need to have the ability. And for a lot of people, the ability means making something small to start off with, right?
Yep.
And that's a big part of your talk, obviously. And then the third part is having a trigger. And so being able to, like, if you want to get fit to do one push-up and maybe do it, your trigger is right before you go to lunch. And then you keep increasing that until you achieve the goal that you want to achieve. So I just want to throw it out there as a reference for folks. The second is... small is very empowering for making change, but it's also very empowering for the folks who want to stop change. Because if you think about, like, what's happening with gun control, It's the incremental, like they're the folks who are, I'm just using that example, not trying to make it a like pro or con, but folks who are opposed to change in gun policy view the small changes as the lever in which big change will happen, in which somebody will take all their guns away.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to point that out, that there's also the opposite side of trying to make
that's
the change.
Actually a really good point, yeah, which I didn't touch on at all, and that small can be a great deterrent. A small, one person standing in front of a tank, you know. If you don't know BJ Fogg, he's great because, as you said, he's got 3 points to making a habit, to making a change, and the last one is called celebration. Which I love. So, you know, let's say you want to get in the habit of doing some small thing like remembering to bring your tote bags when you go to the store. You figure out what is the trigger you need to do, but then when you actually do the thing, you also give yourself a celebration. So your celebration can be anything. It can be like every time you remember your tote bag, yeah, you do a little dance, or you like, I don't know, you like tap your head, and it becomes this like very lovely like physical thing that you do that reminds you of that thing, and that's how you build the habit. So if you haven't checked them out, I recommend that as well. Oh, I was gonna say, so I wanna thank everybody for missing Valerie Jarrett, because I'm sure she was dishing a lot of dirt about the Obamas. If you want to stay in touch, you can always find me at sarahmill.com or on all the social media platforms. And yeah, my climate change newsletter, where I talk about small and just try to highlight different things about different small things every day, is minimum viable planet.com. Yeah, and if you want to pass your post-its, I'll collect them all and read them and steal all your ideas and take a photo. And then, yeah, I will email you in a couple weeks just to say, did you do this thing? And I will shame you. No, I will shame you if you don't do it. But yeah, I hope you do it, and I hope this helps you do it. So thank you so much for coming. Thanks.
Hey, everybody. I just wanted to share, this is an example of one of Sarah's pieces, and yes, it's a couple of pages here. In addition to, do you have these on your website?
I don't.
Yeah, so if you go to yesmagazine.org and search on Sarah Lazarevic, you'll find all of her comic essays that she's done, but a couple of fun little ones just because I think they're funny. She's got this picture in the top left here of two people riding a bike, and the heading says, Small creates new norms. And the one guy says, why do you ride a bike? And the gal says, because I'm a deeply unoriginal person and everyone's doing it. there's another one down the bottom that's goal attainment is about little victories. And it's a person sitting with a little notebook on her lap, and she's writing with some check boxes. And it says, stop using plastic bags, fly less, overthrow world order to save the planet. So again, it's about those little things going on. So
thank you.
They're beautiful, and there's one coming out in our latest issue, which is on travel, radical travel, and that'll be out in a few weeks. So thank you again for coming, and thank you,
thank
Sarah.
You. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And if you like the show, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find us. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. And remember to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.